Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack Andrea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. They may be closed, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackandrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, and mugs. Online, jackandrea.com. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, we're going to be hearing from journalist Tiffany Cross talking about her latest book, Say It Louder. In part two, from the archives, a conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning writer John Meacham and his examination of the career of our third president, Thomas Jefferson. Here's part one. And for this portion of WGTD's Morning Show, I am very happy that we can connect with Tiffany D. Cross. You have very likely seen her and heard her in the work that she has done for BET, CNN, MSNBC. She is co-founder of the news outlet The Beat, DC. And directly to our point today, she is the author of a brand new book, which is also an incredibly timely book, called Say It Louder, Black Voters, White Narratives, and Saving Our Democracy. In this book, Tiffany Cross not only looks at the present situation in terms of our country and its racial divide, but also sets that in some historical context. And one of her abiding concerns is that the story of all this is being largely told through a mainstream media that in so many respects is white in its perspective, white sort of in its orientation, and so it is a story that is being told often in rather incomplete or shallow fashion, and that is a problem that she seeks to address in her book and to bring to our attention. And I'm glad that we can have her to speak about her book, which is published by Armistead, again titled Say It Louder, Black Voters, White Narratives, and Saving Our Democracy. Tiffany D. Cross, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thank you. I'm very excited to be here.
And I should have mentioned you are a 2020 resident fellow at Harvard's Kennedy School's Institute of Politics. You wrote this book before certain dramatic events had occurred. You wrote this book before the onset of COVID, and then you had also written this book before the murder of George Floyd that, of course, set in motion widespread protests and demonstrations across the country. Could you have imagined that this book would be as timely as it is?
Well, COVID definitely, I think, took the world by surprise. So that definitely was off-putting, I would say. But I wasn't surprised, unfortunately, at the uptick in violence against black people in law enforcement. I was surprised at the media coverage of it this time around. Because like you said, I wrote this before George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor and on. But as you know, in the book, I go through several killings, high-profile killings that were shaping the media narrative around 2016. So it's sadly that the news cycle gave me such a timely boost to talk about these issues. In my book, it's interesting because I was literally writing about every single thing happening at the height of the pandemic. And it just shows how timeless that brutality can be on the rising majority of the country.
I heard you in another interview say that you wrote this book, in a sense, as a letter, an open letter, a public letter to black voters, but that you do not want this book to be read only by black voters. Tell us more about kind of that dual purpose or a multi-purpose of why you wrote this book and for whom you wrote this book.
Yeah, so I definitely wrote it to black voters and black people, really, because not all black people vote. But it's not exclusively for black people because I do think as the rising majority of the country, there should be some intellectual curiosity about all of us who have to share this space together. And I think there's a lot of false narratives that we were taught in school because pedagogy lent itself to narratives of kind white slave owners and, you know, only allies, but never to the brutality of what was brought down upon black people in this country. And so I think that's why some people are so put out by outrage around the Confederate flags, or some people are so caught off guard when you start to talk the truth about the founding fathers of this country, because they simply don't know the history and how that history has been oppressive to people who look like me. And so I hope there's a healthy level of intellectual curiosity in this country, that people would pick up something. And moreover, you look, black people read and consume things. Well, we are not reflected all the time, but we're certainly affected. And so I think it's high time that everyone starts to participate in these conversations. And look, I was very comfortable making people uncomfortable in the book, but what I have found is in conversations with this book, people are not as uncomfortable, you know, because we're having these conversations, and the more we talk about them, the more routine they are, the more understanding there is, the more allies are built. There's also intellectual curiosity around other communities of color. For the first time, Latinx population eclipsed black people in terms of eligible voters, not registered voters. The Asian American population is the fastest growing demographic. Native Americans decide federal elections across this country. And so I think even within my own community, there's been some healthy curiosity about other communities and their struggles and their challenges. So, yeah, I would, and even if you're not into politics, I didn't write it in a very, you know, D.C. tattering class way. It was a very conversational style that made, you know, pertinent historical context digestible and everyday occurrences in the Beltway comprehensible. So I hope that it's informative and it's not a, you know, long history lesson that's sad. You know, there are some parts that are funny, and, you know, my attempt at wit and humor has been well received by some. Yeah. So, yeah, I really hope that people enjoy the book but also learn something.
And I want to mention, too, and I think it's an interesting choice on your part, that this is not just a book that is kind of a academic tome about the history of our country and oppression and so on, but it's also a deeply personal book. In fact, the whole first part of the book is titled How I Got Here, and then part two is How We Got Here. And right. I think it's an intriguing choice you make to try to weave, in a sense, two different kinds of canvases together, one that is very personal, a reflection of what you have experienced yourself, but also the experience of blacks as a whole and throughout history.
Definitely. I wanted to make this book very personal. I wanted to walk people and use my narrative as a backdrop to some of the systemic challenges that the country has. And I wanted to write without fear. You know, I wanted to write freely. I remember my editor a few times said to me, "Hey, I don't want you to be embarrassed about anything that you're putting in here." And I told him one time, I said, "Hey, you know, one more time tell me not to be embarrassed about something," because I was never embarrassed to begin with. This is my story. It's my testimony. And I also just wanted, you know, people, regardless of what you look like on the outside, just to know that you can overcome your circumstances and that things will be challenging. And, you know, the world may not always be a friendly place, but you can hurdle these obstacles and, you know, still achieve whatever it is you're trying to achieve, with the understanding that, yes, I get that it's not easy, and I get that, you know, systemic oppression still exists and that not everyone's going to make it. And I just wanted to acknowledge that truth for everybody while speaking my own truth.
Part of the story that you think remains, to some extent, underappreciated by the American public as a whole is something that I think you refer to as generational trauma, which helps us understand how even the very overt kind of oppression that once existed, that perhaps has been excised to some extent, still has carrying power, and that even as progress is made, there is a lingering cost to what was experienced a generation or two or three or four that is still with so many people. Explain that notion of generational trauma and the most important ways you think that that plays out in people's lives today.
Yeah, and can I just take a moment of personal privilege and say I love your question. I love this conversation we're having because I really feel like you get the book and you really connect it with a lot of the points I was making. So I really appreciate that. And I would just say about generational trauma is, you know, as a Black person growing up, my mother was born at a time where she couldn't sit anywhere on the bus. She was born during the era of Jim Crow. My grandparents were born during even more oppressive times. And their parents told them stories. And so that experience certainly carried through and rippled through generations. And I heard stories about, you know, Black men in my family who fought in the First World War and who were incredibly disrespected. And so it carries in how we deal in our everyday lives. So I don't remember anybody ever telling me that I was different. I don't remember anybody telling me that there were some racist white people in the country. It was something that was just understood by osmosis until I experienced it firsthand. And when I did, I wasn't caught off guard. I wasn't surprised. And I think that is the fear and intention of Black parents to protect their children from the world, but arm them with defense mechanisms and coping skills when they encounter something that they know so well, that they know firsthand. And I felt like my family armed me with that, but that all stems from generational trauma, and that expresses itself, it manifests in ways where you can be in a room full of Black people, all Black people in the room. When one white person enters that room, the entire conversation changes because we have some trust issues, and that's, you know, considering the past, that's very understandable. But even that stems from generational trauma. I don't even have to know any other Black people in that room. But we all know that a white person has entered, ergo, we're going to watch what we say, we're going to watch what we do, because there is such a history of violent brutality against Black people that I think so many people are unfamiliar. And so I highlight a lot of that in my book, and I think it's the commonality that Black people who were brought here as an enslaved people have connected with. The blood of the slave runs through our veins. The desire for freedom, the protection of freedom, is something we're armed with. It's, nobody values freedom more than the people of the descendant of those who didn't have it. And so we recognize white supremacy a lot faster than some people. We recognize oppression that's coming from the highest office of the land. We weren't surprised when Donald Trump was elected as president. We were almost anticipating it because we had seen double after double after double rule. We had been the victims of violent white rule. And all of that stems from generational trauma. But if I may just offer a little bit of hope in this moment where we're reimagining America, that generational trauma has armed us with the impassioned voice to demand that we are not going back. And in this moment, we will create a government that is truly by the people, of the people, and for the people. And we will be damned if for the people does not include us. Mm.
You mentioned white supremacy, and at one point in the book, you liken white supremacy in America to the iPhone, in the sense that the iPhone or devices like it tend to be released and then re-released in a different format or a different version or a different model, and likewise, something like white supremacy does not look the same, is not acted upon in 2020 the way it was, for instance, in 1920 or 1820.
Right.
But there are ways in which it is still white supremacy, and probably ways in which, not always, but in many cases, we are talking about a very subtle kind of white supremacy that is maybe more difficult for some people to see and identify and understand. Versus white supremacy that was carried out in a sense more brazenly and openly. What do you think is most important for us to understand about kind of the shifting face of white supremacy?
Thank you, and I so appreciate that question. So I think there are some people who think, I don't participate in white supremacy because I don't wear a Klan robe. I'm not going to skinhead meetings, so, you know, I'm not participating in it. And white supremacy doesn't always show up that way. There's also an instance to say well, you're saying systemic racism, and that's suggesting everybody's racist, and that's just not true. When in fact, it's the opposite. We're indicting the system itself, that some people can benefit from a system that has an adverse effect on people of color. And when people say, well, I'm not a racist because I don't wear a Klan robe, we all have biases, we all have prejudice, but there is also some racism. And so I would say some highlights of that include, you know, for example, do you remember when those two black guys in Georgia ran down, they weren't law enforcement, but they ran down a 25-year-old white jogger and shot him? No, you don't remember that, because that never happened. And if it did happen, those two black men would have been charged and locked up immediately. But when two white men do it, it takes a huge national push to get justice. But it takes videotapes. You know, it takes this black tragedy porn decorating our screens. And as I punctuate this point in the book, I say black people have always had to die in spectacular fashion to pierce the white narrative of what happens to us. That is a form of white supremacy. And that's the most dramatic one. That's something that literally cost us our lives. But there are so many smaller microaggressions that happen every day. The attitude of superiority. This is why you see so many people deputize themselves as law enforcement and will roll up on anybody, any black person or brown person, and demand to know why they're there, do they live there, what are they doing, as though it's any of their business. That's white supremacy. It's when you show up at an office and you feel you have to defend and define why you're there, but nobody ever, you could be an Ivy League school educator, an Ivy League school graduate, an HBCU graduate, and people are questioning, how did you get here? Yet you look to your left and your right, and nobody ever says, how did these basic, average, ordinary white people next to me get here? Our path looks different. That's a form of white supremacy. And so I think everyone has to own the role they played in the system to achieve a better society and not be so defensive, not be defensive to say, well, I didn't do it. You know, it's not me. But instead, maybe look at your life and how you can be an ally and how you can be helpful instead of trying to defend a system that has so historically harmed so many people. We're not making it up. You know, you see these things with your own eyes. You experience them. Nobody can say. So many people have come to me and said, oh, I didn't know it was this bad. And I have to push back on that a little and say, yeah, you're the same. You're in your 40s. Of course you knew. You chose to look away. You chose to participate. And that's fine. But now that we're in this moment, how will you correct that going forward? People knew Aunt Jemima was an ugly stereotype. People knew what Uncle Ben's on the rice box cover meant. We can't pretend that in this year of our Lord, 2020, that somebody said, what? That's racist? I had no idea. This is a generational trauma that helps us pry BS when we hear that. And so this is my contention to ask people, do some self-examination. Don't be so quick to be defensive and really look inward to see how can I ally? Because power concedes nothing without demand. And we're at a moment now where the rising majority of the country is demanding power. A cultural shift is fine, but it means nothing if it doesn't come with the power shift.
I want to give you a moment to talk about what you have seen in the media that has frustrated you so much. At one point, you say in the book, when it comes to our politics, white media gatekeepers are bleaching the black American experience. What do you mean by that process of bleaching the black American experience?
So I mean that in every political conversation that happens in mainstream media, white people are centered. There's rarely, until very recently, there's rarely been conversations that center black folks. And so you take voter suppression, for example. Recently, we saw the video of black people in Wisconsin, not just black people, but everybody in Wisconsin, waiting in these long lines in the rain. And now this is a big story. But that has been the reality for black voters for decades, really for the past century. But after the Voting Rights Act passed, for decades. And it didn't become a story until it started to impact white people. So never mind that black people have fewer polling places, that waiting in line for hours to vote is routine. It's certainly not a story. Never mind that black voters are purged from the rolls at disproportionate rates to our white counterparts. But when Donald Trump started attacking mail-in ballots, that impacted white people. And so then it became, oh, well, we had better focus on voter suppression. There's also these cute little nicknames like NASCAR dads and soccer moms, this is all euphemism for white people, as though black voters are a homogenous group, because when you get to black voters, it's simply the black vote. Such and such candidate is not winning the black vote. But black people disaggregate the same way white voters do when you hear non-college educated white men, college educated white women. Well, black voters certainly disaggregate in those categories as well, but you don't hear that. And I think that creates an issue. Even covering police brutality was not something that was routine. Imagine had we been covering police brutality since Rodney King, the impact that would have had on our landscape. We saw that in Missouri, they were basically funding their tax base off of harassing black people. Law enforcement was pulling over black people with trumped-up charges. But we only knew about that after the deadly shooting of Mike Brown. So these are all, I could go on and spend an hour showing you examples, but these are all examples of how our stories have never been centered. Mm. We've never been the subject of this level of conversation. And even now, when you see people trying to correct their steps and you have certain outlets saying, oh, well, we're going to have a race editorial team, it's still treating us as though we're the side dish. And I'm not a French fry. You know, it's like, no, you are still missing the point, and you're still out of step with the changing demographics of the country. We are no longer the side dish. We are all equal parts at this point, and eventually will be the majority of the population as communities of color. And so if these outlets don't get it right, we'll continue to see more people get their news and information from outlets that may be nefarious, as we saw in 2016 when a lot of black voters started to turn to me and Facebook posts, because if the only time they saw outrage was in a meme about Sandra Bland or about the 12-year-old Tamir Rice or about Trayvon Martin, then those were voices that they felt connected with them, that acknowledged their pain and their own trauma, while the mainstream media did not always get the accurate take.
So in the midst of all that angers you and or frustrates you, you do see some reason for hope, I think, even in what we are seeing playing out in the more recent demonstrations, that perhaps this is at least the start of turning some corner?
I do. I certainly think so. But again, I think it happens by evolution or by force. I think in this moment, for some people, it might be a revolution, and I celebrate that, but I would say it's an evolution. You can disagree or agree with the revolution. You can stand on either side. Evolution happens with or without you. You either get on board or you get left behind. We are in an evolution, and I think as we start to demand power, because, again, a lot of the media narrative is, you know, white NFL owners should allow black people to kneel. White people should allow black people their freedom. White NASCAR owner should allow black drivers to wear Black Lives Matter. The power structure still rests solely with white Americans as the ruling class. And with this culture shift, there's going to have to be a power shift. And that's when you will start to see real change. And I think, you know, we have to be careful not to settle for crumbs, not to say, oh, you took Aunt Jemima off the pancake box. I'm glad we got that whole systemic racism thing all wrapped up. That ain't going to get it, you know. I think the ante has gone up, and that, you know, the rising majority of this country is going to demand representation, not just on camera, but in the C-suite, in executive offices, in decision-making, in ownership, in equity. And so I look forward to that. I look forward to being a part of that. I look forward to pushing for that. And I look forward to sitting at the helm of the table instead of always begging for a seat.
The book again is Say It Louder, Black Voters, White Narratives, and Saving Our Democracy, published by Armistead, the author, Tiffany D. Cross. Tiffany D. Cross, thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about your powerful book.
Thank you so much. This was such a delightful conversation. I thank you so much for having me.
And the time is 8:34. This is the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD, and here's part two. And for this portion of WGTD's Morning Show, I'm turning to the archives for a memorable conversation from 2012 with Pulitzer Prize-winning author John Meacham, who has written so many illuminating books about American history. On this particular occasion, we were talking about his book, Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power, published by Random House. I am sort of struck by the difference between writing a book about, for instance, Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill, where you conceivably could have spoken, I don't remember now, but you could conceivably could have spoken to people who knew both of those men, or certainly were close to them in one way or another. When one reaches back to the early 19th century to someone who died in 1826, I should think it is a profoundly different experience. Tell us what is challenging about reaching back to a figure like Andrew Jackson, or even earlier, to a figure like Thomas Jefferson.
Well, you're exactly right. The interviews are harder to get. they require, you know, Henry Wallace and mediums. What's complicated about it is, well, it's at once, like everything, it's at once more complicated and more simple, because you are confronted with this vast documentary record, particularly in Jefferson's case, more than 22,000 letters, and you know, and the all the scholarship, all of the contemporary letters from the early republic. He played a major role in basically every political event of note, roughly from the time he went to Philadelphia in 1775 as a delegate to the Continental Congress, really until he died. So through the Missouri Compromise up to the presidency of John Quincy Adams. So it's an enormous life, and a little bit like Churchill's in that way, in that he had a hand in so many things. What one has to do is really read, not between the lines necessarily, but always read in context what these daily letters were like. Because, you know, for the 18th and 19th century, their letters were like our phone calls, or our emails now, I guess. They were expressions of the thoughts of a moment. And oftentimes, you know, we tend to privilege, to use that term, anything written as a clearly thought out, firmly held belief. With someone like Jefferson, he was restlessly intellectual. He was relentlessly curious, prolific letter writer. Anything that struck him, he would write a letter. And because he was so eloquent, these things sometimes slip into the secondary literature as Jeffersonian convictions. When, in fact, the task for someone like me is to go back and try to recreate what was going on that week, what was happening that day that made him so pro-French or so anti-Adams or whatever it would be. And so, in a way, it's more of a detective story the farther back you go, because you're dealing with a written trail of clues, as opposed to the more contemporary figures, where you're right, you can more easily capture the sense and smell of a room. I think I interviewed the last 11 or 12 people who had been in the room together with Roosevelt and Churchill, and they'd all been younger, obviously, children, young age, but they were still very tactile, very human to them. With Jefferson, with Adams, with Washington, you know, you're using a documentary record to recreate the world.
And of course, as you've already touched on, Thomas Jefferson was a man, in a sense, riddled with contradictions, and it to phrase it that way is, in a sense, to cast it in a really maybe more negative light than is necessary. But I mean, the fact remains that for someone who is trying to paint a rich, full portrait of the man, that's one of the biggest challenges. The fact that I suppose most human beings are complicated, but is it fair to say Thomas Jefferson was more complicated than most?
You know, I sometimes say politicians are like all of us, only more so. And Jefferson is very much like that. He was riddled with contradictions is a totally fair way to put it. He was capable of a level of cognitive dissonance, of holding two opposing ideas in his head at an epic level. But I would argue that many great political leaders, many people who have been in the arena, constrained by time and chance, yet trying to move things forward in a certain direction, amid the conflicting forces of our time, many of those politicians have had these kinds of contradictions. Jefferson is epic in this sense because his were so fundamental. No one articulated the promise of America more brilliantly or more evocatively than Thomas Jefferson. President Obama's inaugural address a few weeks ago was shot through with Jeffersonian language. And Obama didn't even have to quote him. People just knew it. When you talk about all men are created equal, when you talk about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, nobody thinks you're talking about James Madison or Alexander Hamilton or John Adams or George Washington. They know you're talking about Jefferson. So he was this immensely prophetic, eloquent figure. So he articulated the best we could be. But he also showed us what we all too often are, which is flawed, sinful, and falling short of those ideals. And I, one of the things that I found so fascinating in doing this book was James Part, a great 19th century biographer who'd also written about Andrew Jackson, wrote at the end of his Jefferson book in the early 1870s, I think. He said, if America is right, then Jefferson is right. But if Jefferson was wrong, then America is wrong. You know, that's a hell of a burden to put on any one person. You don't hear that about Washington. You don't hear that about Hamilton. You don't hear that about Adams. You don't hear that about Madison. There's something about Jefferson in his vividness of character, in his, I think, really self-evident, to use Benjamin Franklin's edit from the Declaration of Independence, his evident struggles with the ideal and the real that makes him resonate from age to age. He's the one founder that I would really like to sit and have dinner with. I'd love to meet the rest of them, obviously. But if I had to choose, I would want to talk to Jefferson, in part because you could talk about anything. And I think that, that's part of the reason he still lives in our imaginations.
We're speaking today with John Meacham, Pulitzer Prize-winning author, talking about his newest bestseller called Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power. You just touched on something I was so anxious to ask you about, as you just now talked about balancing the ideal with the real. One of the things that leapt out from me as I read your book was two notions of Thomas Jefferson. First of all, that he was, on the one hand, a very cerebral sort of figure, and on the other hand, a real pragmatist. And I think most of us think of those as two different universes, or at least two different solar systems, or maybe two different planets, but we don't often think of someone being intensely cerebral and a pragmatist, able to get things done. And to whatever extent that is rare, a rare duality to find in one person, we find that in Thomas Jefferson. How did he manage to be both of those things?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, that duality, which is a wonderful way to put it, I think is the hallmark of our greatest leaders. And one thing, a game to play, if you're having a dorky night where you need a game, is can you think of a great American leader who did not have that duality? That is, who could not project a vision of a better future, of an optimistic vision of the country, of what the country could be, while also possessing the legislative and practical skills to bring that ideal closer to reality. Lincoln could do it, FDR could do it, John Kennedy could do it, Ronald Reagan could do it, Bill Clinton could do it. But they're not, when you think about it, Jefferson, when you think about it, they're, as you say, they're not exactly natural allies, because to project a vision, prophets can do that, priests, philosophers, intellectuals. There are people who can see forward and inspire, and then there are the purely legislative mechanics. You know, there are the people who can fix things. We get great leaders when we get people who are skilled in both those arts. That's what I call the art of power in the book, is that the art of this, and it's not a science, it is an art, is being able to project an ideal and having the skills to bring it closer to reality. And Jefferson, from age to age, was able to do that. It was one of the things, one of the reasons I wanted to write the book, is I believed that in the popular mind, Jefferson either was seen as a hopelessly irredeemable slave owner. You know, that's where the post-war scholarship, post-World War II scholarship largely was. Or this kind of airy philosopher, the man of Monticello, who was, you know, inventing telescopes, and, you know, he was sort of Galileo with a Virginia accent. You know, there was a kind of sense that he was not attached to reality, which is partly the way he wanted to be seen. You know, the tombstone that says he was the author of the Declaration of Independence, of the Virginia Statute for Religious Liberty, and the founder of the University of Virginia, I think is one of the great acts of misdirection in American history, because he wanted to be remembered for these noble intellectual achievements, because he figured there'd be less controversy about those than anything he had done in his political life. Yet, from 1769 until 1809, for those biblical 40 years, he was almost constantly in public office. But he knew that politics was inherently controversial, and he didn't like controversy. So, in a weird way, he was ambivalent about what he was best at. But a lot of people, I know a lot of people who are like that, you know, who are really good at something, and because they're really good at it, they don't value it. And that's a question for everyone's psychiatrist. But it's a it is a reality. It's a human characteristic. I think that the ability to be either an idealistic realist or a realistic idealist is an incredibly important American political skill.
When we are looking at Thomas Jefferson, we, of course, are looking at such a fascinating part of our nation's history. And not just that those turbulent times in which our nation first took shape and began its life, but those first years of the United States of America, in which there is a painful divide politically, that a lot of us today still do not begin to really understand. Help us understand sort of that basic divide in governance that marks so much of the very first years of the 19th century, and where Jefferson fell in terms of that divide.
Well, it's exactly right. It's if you don't understand the that division that sprung up most vividly in the 1790s, then American history doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Now, I think in the popular mind, we go from 1776 to the Constitutional Convention, and then pretty soon it's Fort Sumter. And that's understandable. I mean, we all condense things. The critical division that became very apparent in 1790, the first full year of the Washington administration. Washington had taken office on April 30th, 1789. Jefferson has returned from France, become Secretary of State. Hamilton has become the Secretary of the Treasury. Adams is Vice President. They go to war, Hamilton and Jefferson, as Jefferson put it, like two cocks in a pit. You know, they were just constantly at each other's throats. And the questions were about the role of the federal government, the role of the financial sector, the fight between strict construction of the Constitution and a broader construction. They divided pretty quickly into what were known as Federalists, which was the more of the Washington, Hamilton, Adams party, and the Republicans, who were not the Republicans of Lincoln, but the first Republicans, which was Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, Gallatin, who were more oriented toward France and decentralized power, whereas the Federalists were more oriented toward centralized power and Britain. My belief, my argument, is that the fear of a British return to power, of a British reconnaissance mission on the American experiment, was the driving political force in Thomas Jefferson's political imagination in the 1790s. And that the war itself, the American Revolution, should be seen, in my argument, not as a 5-6 year war that ran from 76 to 82, 83, but a 50-year war that was sometimes hot, sometimes cold, sometimes quite present, sometimes latent, but always there, really from 1763 and the end of the French and Indian War all the way through the Treaty of Ghent and the end of the War of 1812 and 1815. Now, the good thing about that argument is the British did come back, so Jefferson wins the argument. There did have to be a ratifying conflict to make sure that the British monarchy would not attempt to reclaim its colonies, which, when you think about it, why wouldn't they try? Right? It was a damn miracle that the American Revolution went the way it did militarily anyway. But that question, the question of would we be more open, more cooperative with London, or would we ally ourselves more with Paris, was a central question in the life of the Republic and totally defined our politics. A lot of people don't realize that foreign policy was that important. But for Jefferson and Hamilton, foreign policy was so intimately connected to domestic policy, since we didn't know what was going to happen. We didn't know if the country was going to make it. Mm. Nothing like it ever had. So it was a reasonable fear.
Your book, of course, begins in such dramatic fashion early in 1801, on the eve of what ultimately, of course, becomes the two-term presidency of Thomas Jefferson. But this is a moment in time, of course, when there is very much a question hanging in the air of who is going to be the third president. As you describe this very, very unsettling moment, not only in the life of Thomas Jefferson, but in the life of this young nation, you say that now a quarter century after the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson believed that the United States, as he knew it and loved it, might not long endure. And, of course, here we are now in the year 2013 in the United States of America. We know full well that, rough times or not, the U.S. ultimately does endure. It's probably really important to try to put ourselves back into the mind of someone like Thomas Jefferson at this point in our history when the future is so much more tenuous.
Oh, absolutely. I think one of the reasons to look at history, to think about biography, is to achieve a sense of proportionality. You know, how does the crisis of the present moment stack up against crises of the past? It's one of the reasons I do this, is to try to get some sense of, you know, is the debt ceiling battle really Fort Sumter or the election of 1801, or is it something else? And without that perspective, I don't think there's any way to really rationally try to move forward. Jefferson dealt with existential crises his whole life because he was, in fact, part of a generation that was creating something new. He said in a letter to Joseph Priestley after that very narrow election in 1801, which he almost lost, not with the people, but in Washington. He almost lost it with, there was confusion in the Electoral College. His own running mate was essentially running against him, Aaron Burr. There was talk that they might make John Marshall, then the Chief Justice, and the Secretary of State. He was sort of concurrently serving. Might make him president for a year until they could work it out. We now have the sense that, of course, every 4 years we have this orderly transition. Well, that was the first. That was only the second contested election. 1796 was the first contested election. Adams won. 1800 was only the second. And it took 36, 37 ballots in the House of Representatives before Jefferson won. So the whole thing was tenuous. You know, as Wellington said of Waterloo, it was the damnedest close-run thing you ever saw in your life. And I think that, at least for me, anyway, trying to understand how close we came to disaster or what went into averting disaster is incredibly useful in the broadest sense in understanding what we're supposed to be doing, what we ought to be doing now. Not that there's a way to, you know, send for Jefferson to deal with a debt ceiling. That's anachronistic. I don't mean that. But if we don't understand how the earlier generations fought these battles, then I don't think we're ever going to be able to judge exactly where we stand in terms of the level of crisis and the level of difficulty that we face.
Hmm. You say quite firmly that Thomas Jefferson was the most successful political figure of the first part of the 19th century, both for his own presidency and so many presidents who followed after him, who very much followed in his footsteps, politically speaking. Among many fascinating areas that we could discuss, but with our time just about gone, I'm choosing just one for no particular reason. But I think if we just talk for a moment or two about it, it'll give listeners a sense of all the richness of your book and of this portrait. One of the most intriguing things about Thomas Jefferson is his religious faith, or lack thereof, or what I think you at one point term a rather kind of unconventional belief system for that time and place. And this has been one bone of contention in understanding who he was and the way in which different people have reacted to Thomas Jefferson, to some extent, hinges on this. Would you mind just saying a word about this Sure. complicated facet of Thomas Jefferson?
Absolutely. He was, that's exactly right. He was an unconventional believer, but he was a believer. He believed in a creator God. He believed, interestingly, in a system, a future system of rewards and punishments. He believed in a kind of consciousness of the soul. He thought that he and John Adams are up there right now, wherever there is, looking down, listening to us, which would please Jefferson immensely and Adams not so much. So there was a kind of Aristotelian sense of that. He was in no way a Christian in the way we would think of it. He did not think that the creeds of the church that came up and rose out of the understanding of the life of Jesus of Nazareth were legitimate. He called it monkish superstition. He called the Holy Trinity the mere abracadabra of men calling themselves the priests of Jesus. He tried to create his own Bible. You know, presidents have very few ego problems, but no one else has ever tried to rewrite the New Testament. But Jefferson did, to try to remove the superstitious elements, the mystical elements, and try to recover what he believed to be the moral philosophy at the heart of the Jesus story. It would be almost impossible for Jefferson to win an election today with those religious views. He was much more of a seeker in many ways, of a intellectual about the role of faith. But he did appreciate, and this is an important point, he did appreciate the cultural role of faith as something in the life of a republic that held it together. And so his great goal in fighting for religious liberty was to make sure religion was only one factor among many in shaping the life of the country, that it would never become dominant, but at the same time, you would never persecute people simply on religious grounds.
Hmm. At one point early in the book, you write, Jefferson was a breathing human being who was subject to the passion and prejudice and pride and love and ambition and hope and fear that drive most other breathing human beings. And of course, as you go on to say, the whole aim of your marvelous book is to try to paint a rich, vibrant portrait of exactly that, Thomas Jefferson as a human being. The book is Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power, published by Random House, and its author, John Meacham. John Meacham, thank you so much for making time in your busy schedule to talk with me about this really fascinating book, and I thank you again for writing it.
Always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
And tomorrow on The Morning Show, two guests, and one of them will be Gwida Brown from the Hope Council for Alcohol and Other Drug Abuse. And we will find out about the work that they are doing during the constraints of the COVID-19 pandemic. On Friday, The author of a fascinating book called The Design of Future Things. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. Their doors may be closed right now, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackanddrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts,